Drake's farm was the sprawling black township which almost a million souls called home. From here it was out of view to the east of the highway, but the smoke from the thousands of cooking fires hazed the sky to a dirty leaden grey. The wage-earners of Drake's farm commuted daily by train or bus to their workplaces in the homes and factories and businesses of the white areas of the Witwatersrand. The huge commercial and mining complex of Greater Johannesburg was surrounded by these dormitory townships, Drake's Farm and Soweto and Alexandria. Under the bizarre conditions of the Group Areas Act, the entire country was divided up into areas reserved for each of the racial groups. "When did you last eat?" Michael asked the child gently.
"I ate yesterday in the morning, Great Chief."
Michael took a 5-rand banknote from his wallet. The child's eyes seemed to expand into a pair of luminous pools as he stared at it. He had almost certainly never possessed so much money at one time in his short life. Michael proffered the note. The child snatched it and turned and ran, tripping over the skirts of the dangling cardigan. He gave no thanks, and his expression was one of desperate terror, lest the gift be taken back from him before he could escape. Michael laughed with delight at his antics, and then suddenly his amusement turned to outrage. Was there another country in the modern first world, he wondered, where little children were still forced to beg upon the streets? Then mingled with his anger was a sense of utter hopelessness. Was there any other country that embraced both the members of the first world, like his own family, with its vast estates and stunning collection of treasures, and the desperate poverty of the third world epitomized here in the townships? The contrast was all the crueler for being so closely juxtaposed. "If only there was something I could do," he lamented, and drew so hard on his cigarette that a full inch of ash glowed, and a spark fell unnoticed onto his tie, and scorched a spot the size of a pinhead. It did not make much difference to the general appearance of his attire. A small blue delivery van turned off the main highway into the car park. It was driven by a young black man in a peaked cap. The sign writing on the body read, "Fuza Muhli Butri, 12th Avenue, Drake's Farm." The name promised good eating. Michael flashed his lights as he had been instructed to do. The van pulled into the parking bay directly in front of him. Michael climbed out and locked the valiant before he crossed to the blue van. The rear doors were unlocked. Michael climbed in and slammed them behind him. The body of the van was more than half filled with baskets containing packages of raw meat, and the skinned carcasses of a number of sheep hung from the hooks in the roof.
"Hey, come this way,"
the driver called to him in Zulu, and Michael crawled down the length of the body. The hanging carcasses brushed against him, and the drippings stained the knees of his corduroy bags. The driver had prepared a niche for him between two of the meat baskets, where he would be hidden from casual inspection.
"There will be no trouble," the driver assured him in cheerful Zulu. "Nobody ever stops this van."
He pulled away, and Michael settled down on the grubby floor. These theatrical precautions were annoying but necessary. No white was allowed into the township without a permit issued by the local police station in consultation with the Township Management Council. In the ordinary course of events, this permit was not difficult to obtain. However, Michael Courtney was a marked man. He had 3 previous convictions for contravention of the Publications Control Act, for which he and his newspaper had been heavily fined. Under the Act, the government censors had been given almost unlimited powers of banning and suppression of any material or publication, and they were encouraged by the full caucus of the ruling National Party not to flinch from exercising those powers to uphold the Calvinistic moral views of the Dutch Reformed Church and to protect the political status quo. What chance, then, did Michael's writings have against their vigilance? Michael's application for a permit to enter Drake's Farm Township had been summarily rejected. The blue van entered the main gates of the township without a check, and the indolent, uniformed black guards did not even glance up from their game of African Ludo, played with Coca-Cola crown tops on a carved wooden board.
"You can come up front now,"
the driver called, and Michael clambered over the meat baskets to reach the passenger seat in the cab. The township always fascinated him. It was almost like visiting an alien planet. It was back in 1960, almost 11 years ago, that he had last visited Drake's Farm. At that time, he had been a cub reporter for the Mail. That was the year in which he had written the Rage series of articles that were the foundation on which his journalistic reputation was built, and incidentally the grounds for his first conviction under the Publications Control Act. He smiled at the memory and looked around him with interest as they drove through the old section of the township. Now this dated from the previous century, the Victorian era during which the fabulous golden reefs of the Witwatersrand had been discovered close by. The old section was a maze of lanes and alleys and higgledy-piggledy buildings, shacks and shanties of unburnt brick and cracked plaster, of corrugated iron roofs painted all the shades of an artist's palette. Most of the original colours had faded and were running with the red leprosy of rust. The narrow streets were rutted and studded with potholes and puddles of indeterminate liquid. Scrawny chickens scurried and scratched in the litter of rubbish. A huge sow with a pink hide that looked as though it had been parboiled wallowed in one of the puddles and grunted irritably as the van passed. The stink was wondrous. The sour stench of ripening garbage mingled with that of the open drains and the earthen toilets that stood like sentry boxes behind each of the hovels. The government health inspector had long ago abandoned all hope of ever regulating the old section of Drake's farm. One day the bulldozers would arrive, and the Mail would run front-page photographs of the distraught black families crouching on the pathetic piles of their worldly possessions, watching the brutal machines demolishing their homes. A white civil servant, in a dark suit, would make a statement on the state television network about this festering health hazard making way for comfortable modern bungalows. The anticipation of that day made Michael angry all over again. The blue van bumped and weaved over the rutted lanes, passing the dismal shebeens and whorehouses, and then crossed the invisible line from the old into the new section that the same civil servant would describe as comfortable modern bungalows. Thousands of identical brick boxes with grey corrugated asbestos roofs stood in endless lines upon the treeless veldt. They reminded Michael of the rows of white wooden crosses that he had seen in the military cemeteries of France. Yet somehow the black residents had managed to imprint their character and individuality upon this forbidding townscape. Here and there a house had been repainted, a startling colour in the monotonous grubby white lines. Pink, or sky blue, or vivid orange, they bore witness to the African love of bright colour. Michael noticed one that had been beautifully decorated in the traditional geometric designs of the Indibele tribe from the north. The tiny front gardens were a mirror of the personal style of the occupants. One was a square of dusty bare earth, another was planted with rows of maize plants and had a milking goat tethered at the front door, yet another boasted a garden of straggly geranium plants in old 5-gallon paint tins, while still another was fenced with high barbed wire and the weed-clogged yard was patrolled by a bony but ferocious mongrel guard dog. Some of the plots were separated from each other by ornamental walls of concrete breeze blocks, or old truck tyres painted gaudy colours and half buried in the brick-hard earth. Most of the cottages had extraneous additions tacked onto them, usually a lean-to of salvaged lumber and rusty corrugated iron, into which a family of the owner's relatives had overflowed. There were abandoned motor vehicles, sans engine or wheels, parked at the curb. Hillocks of old mattresses, disintegrating cardboard boxes and other discarded rubbish, which the refuse removal service had overlooked, stood on the street corners. Across the stage moved the people of the townships. These were the people whom Michael loved more than his own race or class, the people with whom he empathized and for whom he agonized. They delighted him endlessly. They amazed him endlessly with their strength and fortitude and will to survive. The children were everywhere he looked, the crawlers and totterers and squawkers who rolled and roisted in the streets like litters of glossy black Labrador puppies, or rode high, strapped to their mothers' backs in the traditional style. The older children played their simple games with wire and empty beer cans, which they had fashioned into toy automobiles. The little girls played with skipping ropes in the middle of the road, or imitated the games of hopscotch and catch that they had seen the white children play. They were tardy and reluctant to give way and clear the roadway when the driver of the blue van hooted at them. When they saw Michael's white face, they danced beside the slow-moving van with cries of, "Sweetie! Sweetie!" Michael had come prepared, and he tossed them the hard sugar candy with which he had stuffed his pockets. Though most of the adult population had made the long daily journey to their workplace in the city, the mothers and the old people and the unemployed had been left behind. Gangs of street youths stared at him expressionlessly as he passed, gathered in idle groups on the littered street corners. Though he knew that these teenagers were the jackals of the townships, who preyed upon their own kind, Michael's sympathy went out to them. He understood their despair. He knew that even before they had fairly embarked on life's journey, they were aware that it held nothing for them, no expectation or hope of better things or kinder times. Then there were the women at their chores, hanging the long lines of laundry to dry like prayer flags on the breeze, or stooped over the black three-legged pots in the backyards, cooking the staple maize porridge of their diet over open fires in the traditional way, preferring that to the iron stoves in the tiny cottage kitchens. The smoke of the fires mingled with the blown dust to form the perpetual cloud that hung over the township. The illegal hawkers, or spuzas, who had eluded the Afrikaner government's passion for regulations and licensing, wheeled their barrows and shouted their wares in the busy streets. The housewives bartered with them for a single potato or cigarette or orange or slice of white bread, depending on their circumstances. Despite these dreary surroundings and all the evidence of poverty and neglect, Michael heard in every street and at every corner they turned the sound of laughter and music. The laughter was spontaneous and merry. Their shouted greetings and repartee were carefree. Wherever he looked were those lovely African smiles that filled his heart and then squeezed it to the point of pain. The music rang and echoed from the bleak little cottages, and in the streets from the transistor radios that men and women carried in hand or balanced on their heads as they walked. The children played their penny whistles and banjos, made from paraffin tins and wood and pieces of wire. They danced and they sang in a spontaneous expression of the sheer joy of living, even in these most insalubrious circumstances. For Michael, the laughter and the music depicted the indomitable spirit of the black African in face of all hardship. For him there could not be another race on earth quite like them. Michael loved them, every one of them, no matter what age or sex or tribe or condition. He was of Africa, and these were his people. "What can I do for you, my brothers?" he whispered. "What can I do to help you? I wish I knew. Everything I have attempted so far has failed. All my efforts have died like a hopeless shout upon the desert air. If only I could find a way." Then, abruptly, he was distracted. They topped a rise in the gently undulating veldt, and Michael straightened in his seat. 11 years ago, when last he had passed this way, there had been nothing but open grassland here, with a few scrawny goats grazing amongst the red wounds with which erosion and neglect had raked the earth. "Nob's Hill," the driver of the van chuckled at his surprise. "Beautiful, eh?" Such is the determination and fortitude of men, that even in the face of the most adverse circumstances, there are those few who will not only survive, but who, with courage and ingenuity far beyond the average, will flourish and rise high above the obstacles and pitfalls with which their path is strewn. Along the low ridge of ground, standing above the huddled shacks and cottages of Drake's farm, were the homes of the black elite. There were 100 or so of these successful men set apart from all the million inhabitants of Drake's farm. Through business acumen and natural ability and hard work, they had wrested material success from the hands of their white political masters, from those who had attempted to dictate their fate through the monumental framework of interlocking laws and regulations, which was the Verwoerd-inspired policy of apartheid in action. Yet their victory over circumstances was hollow. No matter that they could afford to make their home in any part of this land, they were constrained by the Group Areas Act to live only in these areas which those architects of apartheid had set aside for them. The homes that these black businessmen and doctors and lawyers and successful criminals had built for themselves would have graced the elegant suburbs of Sandton or La Lucia or Constantia, where their white counterparts lived. "See," the driver of the van pointed proudly, "their pink house with the big windows. It is the home of Josiah Nrubu, the famous witch doctor. He sells his charms and potions and spells by mail order all over Africa, even to Nigeria and Kenya.